What's poppin', everyone? Welcome to episode 52 of The Next Bite, and this one is all about drones. So we're talking about a drone overview, then we're going diving right into it. Drones that are flying around on the moon and on asteroids, not using air, but using ions to propel themselves. I think it's pretty interesting. Then after that, we talk about life-saving drone deliveries, how drones can help in the medical space, the impact they can make, and why we think drones in the medical space is the best application for this technology. So if you're excited about this at all, let's buckle up, take off. We're flying away with drones, episode 52. I'm Daniel.
And I'm Forbode.
And this is the Next Bite podcast. Every week, we explore interesting and impactful tech and engineering content from Weevolver.com and deliver it to you in bite-sized episodes that are easy to understand, regardless of your background. All right, folks, like we said, this one is all about drones, and who better to give us an overview of drones than our loyal sponsor, Mouser. Forbode and I have obviously expressed our support and excitement for Mouser Electronics, but if I were to start buying a drone, I'd probably start there if I were building a drone to find some of these components. But also, this article that we have linked in our show notes, it's like Drones 101. It's like the primer class or the primer article to understanding everything about drones, their potential applications, the hardware that's involved, the technology, developments, everything. That's where I'd start. And I don't know, like I used it as a reference for understanding what I needed to create this, the research for this episode.
I'm in the same boat, dude. Like, kind of spoiler alert, but I talk about robots being, or drones being used for medical deliveries. And one of the projects I talk about is actually mentioned in this article. So when I was researching that, this article came up and I use it as a resource. So if you're interested in this space, but you know, you don't have too much of an idea what's been going on in terms of, you know, research and academia and industry challenges and successes, definitely give it a read. It's very useful.
Yeah. Or if anything that we say today sounds interesting and you want to find a tangential project to do some more research into or look at, you know, what type of hardware they use or where to find it, I think you should check out this episode. We're going to link it down in our show notes. Okay. Cool. I'm going to jump into our first article. And this one, I would say it loosely qualifies as a drone. It's actually more like a UFO. That's what it looks like, okay. At least, if you check this out.
Like the saucers that we see in
it looks exactly like a flying saucer, and it's from MIT. And basically the point is to make a rover, like the ones that crawl around on Mars and on the moon, but make one that flies. And so,
okay,
let me just zoom out and talk about the challenges involved with making something that flies on a planet that's not Earth or a satellite that's not Earth. We talked about all the challenges involved with the flying drone on Mars in episode 12, mm-hmm. the Ingenuity drone that NASA made. And that was challenging because the atmosphere is much thinner on Mars than it is on Earth. So it's harder to make this thing fly. Well, on the moon and on other airless bodies like giant asteroids and stuff like that, there's virtually no atmosphere whatsoever. So they're basically saying, let me figure out a way to make something fly without any air. So I can't use a rotor or anything to make this thing get lift or wings or anything like that. So they want to try to find a way to make something fly. And the reason they want to do that is because of all the challenge that comes with mechanical components driving around on the dusty surfaces and all those insane temperatures. So in episode 20, Forbode, you and I talked about how challenging it is for NASA to design a new moon rover because of all the temperature swings on the surface of the moon, all the dust that might damage the mechanical components. They're basically saying if we don't have to have anything moving, like wheels and motors and all that stuff, if we just have something that somehow hovers, you know, flies like a flying saucer, we might be able to reduce a lot of the complexity involved in designing a rover that can crawl around the surface of the moon or an asteroid or something like that.
You know, like a while ago, I think it's like 2 or 3 years ago at this point, I remember a video from MIT where they had like a little plane, like an RC plane that didn't have any actuators. So like no engines, no propellers. I think it was like ion propelled. So is that what we're getting at here?
Yeah, okay. You kind of like stole my punchline right there, dude. But I'm going to tell the story about how this came about. But the long and short of it is, yeah, they want to use ion propulsion. I'm going to explain what that is. Okay. It took me a while, like a lot of YouTube videos, a lot of Reddit, Eli5 exploring. It
looks like black magic to me.
How this works.
Like, it just does not look like anything real. So I'm looking forward to this shoot.
But let's zoom out. So we talk about, you know, in, you know, the mid 20th century, all these manned missions to the moon. We have, you know, humans walking on the moon for the first time ever, exploring things. They thought they saw, while they were walking around the moon, they thought they saw dust floating for up to, floating from up to 1 meter off the surface, even though there's no air.
Okay.
So they're really confused. Like, how is dust floating in the air where there's no air? The explanation for that actually comes from the photoelectric effect, which was Einstein won a Nobel Prize for discovering this. So this is like super physics. I'm trying to boil it down to the best way I can understand it. And I'd hope if someone has a better understanding of it than I do that listens to this, they can give me a correction if I explain this wrong. But basically, ultraviolet light, like the stuff that comes from the sun, can give things a positive charge. And what happens when things have a positive charge, it's like static electricity. You know, if you rub a balloon on your head and it makes your hair stand up, that's because your hair has a positive charge. So what happens is the surface of the moon has a positive charge because the UV light gives it that charge. And that's why the dust is floating like your hair standing up on end when you have static electricity on you. And, you know, basically that happens because photons are in the light beams that come, you know, the UV light beams that come from the sun, and it excites electrons out of the atoms on the surface. And when electrons leave, electrons are negative, what's left there is atoms with positive charge. So all that to say, when ultraviolet light is involved at the, you know, specific right wavelength and frequency for the type of atom that it's hitting, it is able to leave it with a positive charge, which means it like feels like it has a lot of static electricity. That's why this dust was floating up to 1 meter off the surface. I mean, it's exactly like when your hair stands up on end when you have static electricity on.
In this case, the dust was the hair, and the sunbeam, I guess, what was like the balloon rubbing against the surface of the...
Yeah, stripping electrons away and leaving it with a positive charge so it stands up.
Got it.
This floaty effect from the photoelectric effect of like almost like static electricity only works on the moon and asteroids because there's no atmosphere. So they're talking about, we want to fly in a place where there's no air. Well, also in these places where there's no air, this photoelectric effect happens. And, you know, the atmosphere blocks most of the ultraviolet light that hits Earth. So we don't get that effect here on Earth, but we also have air that can allow things to fly. So they're saying, you know, in this unique situation where there's no air, we also have this floaty static electric effect. Let's see if we can capitalize on this static electric effect by making a rover that, you know, floats on this kind of floaty electrical charge that we get on the surface of the moon and on large asteroids and stuff like that. So the way I think about it is, you know, the same principles that apply to magnets and electricity, where opposites attract and like charges repel. They're trying to make a positively charged rover that will be able to bounce or, you know, repel off of this positively charged surface of the moon, of asteroids, etc., so that it can float and fly based on this, you know, remember, opposites attract, like charges repel. So positive moon, positive rover, they try to get them to repel, to bounce off of each other, to make this rover that floats. And if you look at the photos in this article, we've linked it in the show notes, it looks exactly like a flying saucer. It's like this circular flying rover disc thing that they try to get a positive charge and try to get it to lift off the surface of the moon so that it's floating.
So like, you know, all those circular UFO conspiracy theories might not be conspiracy theories after all, but civilizations that have already cracked this much sooner than we did. All right.
It's possible.
We're not saying, you know, extraterrestrials are real, but...
we're not saying they're not
real. We're not saying they're not real either. I like that. Okay, so this is pretty interesting. I guess one of the questions I still kind of have is, why do they want to make these rovers float so bad?
Well, so I kind of alluded to it earlier, right? One is, when you try to make a rover that's supposed to drive around in this dusty surface, you know, moon dust and on Mars and moon and on asteroids, that dust is especially caustic. It's super sharp because there's not much wind that's, you know, rounding all these particles of dust out. They're actually really sharp, enough so that they think if you breathe lunar dust, it would kill you because it would cut up the inside of your lungs. So imagine that kind of sharp dust cutting up mechanical components like motors, and, you know, the wear and tear gets to it a lot. And then in addition, you've got the opportunity, or I guess the challenge rather, in the extreme temperatures up there to try and lubricate these motors. We've talked about how you have to spend a lot of energy heating oil to lubricate motors to get a roll, get a rover to move around. Basically, they're saying is we can strip all that complexity out if we have something that floats on its own.
Got it.
And they make a bunch of the, they want to make a bunch of these little tiny rovers that can crawl all around the surface of the moon or an asteroid or another, you know, extraterrestrial body to explore it. One challenge that they found is that you have to look at the ratio of gravity to electric charge on the surface. So the larger the body is, the harder it is to get something to float off the surface because there's much more gravity to it. And there's a similar amount of electric charge based on the surface area. So something with a large mass as opposed to its surface area that's getting hit with sunlight, it's really challenging to get these things to float. And one of those things happens to be the moon. So they can't just rely on the photoelectric effect, you know, that floaty static electricity from the sun to get these things to fly on the moon. So what they did is, this is what you were alluding to earlier, Forbode, with ionic thrusters. Basically, they release positive ions. So it increases the positive charge of both the rover and the surface beneath it.
Wait, so
remember we said
releases positive ions. Is it the rover?
The rover.
Okay. Okay, cool.
So it's basically shooting up a bunch of positive charge between the rover and the surface of the moon.
Gotcha.
And what that's doing is it is increasing the force with those two things are repelling from each other, and it floats at a higher distance off the surface of the moon.
Okay, that's cool. So
and so all of this basically to say is, if you've ever tried to put, you know, the positive side of one magnet against the positive side of another magnet, that's all that principle is what they're using to make this thing fly.
Gotcha.
And what they basically did is make that force stronger, because gravity is too strong on the moon to rely simply on the force that is generated by sunlight. They're also using ions to do that.
And ion thrusters are, I guess, powered electrically, right?
Yeah, they're powered electrically. And the one thing that the researchers from MIT said that is really promising in this application is the ionic power sources they had actually didn't require that much power at all.
Really?
It could, they I'm going to quote unquote here, they said basically for free, using solar panels, this solar panels could generate enough electricity for these ionic power sources to be able to be, to propel these things off the surface. Well,
and that was with like a full size rover that would have the equipment that they would want for, you know, a lunar mission.
Yeah. And when we say full size here, we've got to zoom out and talk about what they're talking about. A 2-pound rover on Earth. So,
okay.
So it's a relatively small rover, but what they're talking about is making a swarm of these things. 2-pound rover with a tiny solar panel on top, ionic thruster on the bottom. This thing can float 1 centimeter, greater than 1 centimeter off the surface of the moon and zip around, they said, basically for free using only solar energy.
Wow. Said that's funny, because when you brought up the magnets, in my mind I was like, well, you need to power like this relatively energy intensive magnet to repel something that weighs, you know, however much off the ground. But a tiny solar panel on a 2-kilogram robot can make it float 1 centimeter. That's incredible.
And I wouldn't say this if it wasn't in the article. You know, like I said, in quotes, basically for free.
And it you know, the floaty part, I understand it's just repelling equally. But to navigate around, to move around, does it just change the way the thrusters are reacting with the ground?
I'm imagining that's what they do. Okay. Is they change the thrust so that it's not symmetrical which way the ionic thrust is. So the charge pushes it slightly off to one direction or the other.
I see. So I guess like the main drawback with this approach would be that you can't land your rover, can you?
I don't think so. So yeah. So they'd have to, you know, get another vehicle with which to deploy these rovers on the surface. And I think they could probably turn off the ion thrust on the moon and land. Because remember we said the gravity is too strong for just the photoelectric effect to lift it up. But they're generally, for me, I just think it's super interesting. Every time I think about a drone or something that's flying, it involves aerodynamics.
Right. 100%.
This really, really, truly doesn't involve air. So we talk about like aerospace. I think this is just space. and it's just using ion propulsion, which is generated by the energy from visible sunlight, as well as the photoelectric effect, which is generated from the invisible part of sunlight coming from the sun, to get a better way to explore the moon. They talked about with more ion thrust, they haven't generated a design that can do this yet, but with more ion thrust, they theorized that they could levitate even higher. And that's their end goal, so that you could pass over rough terrain effortlessly. So you wouldn't have to worry about if there's rocks or boulders in the way, you would just float right over them. And that's what they plan to use to explore asteroids like Psyche 16. We talked about it in our episode 14, I think. The largest asteroid we know about, it's got, you know, billions and billions and trillions of dollars worth of rare earth metals on there. They want something to be able to go explore the surface of that. They think one of these levitating rovers might be the way to do it because the surface is so rough and jagged.
Well, on top of that, I mean, I don't know how fast these things move, but the traditional rover is like fairly slow. And because it's very energy intensive with all the processes you mentioned before, keeping the oil hot, yada, 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 it needs to rest up and, you know, get more power and then continue on the mission. So it's not like the most efficient way to explore a huge asteroid. With these.
Yeah. And we've talked before about the benefits of swarms as well.
Right.
You could deploy a bunch of these little things and just crawl the entire surface of the moon and map it. And then we'd know exactly what's there. The drawback, I would say, is this should only, you know, given the photoelectric effect, this should really only work on the bright side of the moon. But still, we'd have an opportunity to crawl the bright side of the moon and map it using this technology that's like little tiny flying saucers.
Wow. This was a really good topic, and you did a really good job at explaining ion thrusters. I came in knowing like absolutely nothing, and now I feel, you know, I feel like I have a decent grasp of the ELI 5 of it.
Well, I did a lot of reading and research to try and figure it out, and I hope one of our listeners might be able to give us a more succinct explanation we can follow up on in a future episode. Yeah.
We should start giving ourselves golden stars for whenever we like think we're knocking it out of the park with explanation. I'll give you a golden star. You know what?
Thanks, buddy. Yeah,
of course. Okay, so let's transition to Article 2. This one is kind of in the same realm because we're talking about drones, but we're back on Earth, okay? We're going to be talking about life-saving drone deliveries. Now, this is coming out of the Technical University of Munich, and it was – this is the part I love. It was a student initiative that was founded in 2019 – composed of 58 undergraduate and graduate students. So they came together, they noticed a problem, and they decided to address it themselves. So what is this problem? They were talking about how in Germany, there is give or take 75,000 sudden cardiac arrest episodes every single year. So that's people getting heart attacks. You know, they call 911. I don't know what the equivalent is in Germany, but they're like, hey, so-and-so is having a heart attack. We need an ambulance. Unfortunately, these incidences only have about an 11% survival rate. There's a bunch of different factors in play. But one of those is that paramedics can't get on site quickly enough to start applying, what is it called? The pads that...
Defibrillators,
yeah. Basically, all the stuff that you should know to do as a first responder. Dan, I think if you went to school in Virginia, they taught us like CPR, how to use a defibrillator, things like that. But obviously, not everyone knows how to do it. And not everyone has access to a defibrillator. And they were talking about how on average, it takes an ambulance anywhere between 9 to 15 minutes to reach one of these calls. And that's only with areas that are actually accessible, so that have roads. If it's somewhere that's very remote, they might not even be able to make it. So knowing this problem and how much it was impacting their society, they were like, look, drones make a lot of sense. Drones aren't limited to roads. They can travel like fairly quickly. And if the idea is just to get a defib into the hands of the right person and with easy instructions on how to apply it, it could dramatically increase the survival rate. So that's the problem that they really wanted to tackle, is how do we develop a drone that is capable of doing that? So they...
Do you know why, and we may not know the answer to this question, do you know why the response time is so high? Is this just because the roads aren't super accessible? I don't like... I'm going to brag on my brother here. He's a firefighter in Reston, Virginia. Their average response time for emergency calls is 3.4 minutes.
Wow.
So I was wondering why their average response time may be so much higher than some places in Germany, but it sounded like one of the major impacts there you'd say is the accessibility of the roads.
That's the main thing that they mentioned in the article.
And that makes sense why a drone would be able to fly there much faster than a car could drive.
Exactly.
There.
Exactly. But yeah, so let's talk about this drone. It's an eVTOL drone. So it's electric powered. VTOL is vertical takeoff and landing. So it can go up and down and then start flying the direction it needs to go.
Is it like a quadcopter or does it have wings?
It has a quadcopter. So it has like the four propellers and it has wings.
Oh.
Yeah.
So yes. It is both a quadcopter and wings.
And the wingspan is 2 to 3 meters. So
this is a big boy.
This is a very big boy. Because like for context, I'm 1.73 meters tall. So you could take two of me, stack me head to toe, and it would pretty much be the wingspan of this drone. Very big.
Yeah. Wow.
But it is capable of flying up to 120 kilometers an hour, which is about 75 miles per hour, which is the speed limit in Virginia, you know, if you abide by that.
That's much faster than an ambulance could drive down rural roads, I'm sure.
Exactly. And even like think about it, in the best case scenario on like some of the major roads, there might be other cars in front of you. The light might be red, so you might have to slow down and wait for people to like stop moving, and then you can move. There's all these challenges, but the drone can just take the fastest route and just fly directly to it.
Yeah. So as the drone flies.
Yeah. So how does it get there? That's kind of the main question, right? It's got all the necessary bells and whistles. It's got GPS. It has machine learning and artificial intelligence to get the best route possible. I do believe at this point it still does have human supervision to an extent. In case something goes wrong, just to make sure we're getting there as safe as possible. And then once it reaches its destination, it deploys a defib with instructions for the user, whoever's on site, to actually start applying it until the paramedics get on site. So they're like bridging that gap of those essential couple minutes right after the incident is reported until when the paramedics can get on site and start doing the full-on procedure to make sure the patient's okay.
It's like the same reason why, I don't know, like most major buildings, schools, universities, stuff like that, movie theaters that you go to, at least here in the US, I see like a defibrillator in a box on the wall. And it's not meant that that will replace the emergency response that's on its way, but it's just to shorten that time between, hey, we realize there's an emergency and someone's responding to it in a way that can assist. And I think what you're saying is for most of these cardiac arrest episodes, response time is a huge factor in improving survival rate.
Absolutely. And you know what? I was kind of curious. I was like, so like what would that data look like? What would be the delta here? And I couldn't find anything for Germany, but looking at the US, the survival rate for cardiac arrest episodes were about the same, but we have much more cases in the US, 356,000 in fact. So give or take like 1,000 a day. And they were saying that survival with EMS treated cardiac arrest is about 10.4%. So you can see like a 0.6% improvement there.
Yeah.
But what was kind of like shocking to me is that a layperson only used AEDs in 7.3% of the cases reported, and only 1.7% of those had a shock delivered. So even, that was really shocking to me. So maybe like being
shocking.
I didn't even mean to do that. But maybe making it easier to access a defib with like really easy instructions and being like, you need to do this right now, would dramatically improve that. And even if it's just like 0.5% more, that's a huge impact if you look at all the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, just the amount of lives that could be saved just by having accessibility to this technology, which is like, you know, automatic external defibrillators are really interesting, but there's not really anything like vastly new that's been developed in those in the last few years. But just having it available, it sounds like it could save a lot of lives, and especially in the rural areas, like in Germany, where they're not able to get a car there fast enough, I doubt they're going to have a defibrillator on hand if you're out in a farmland in the middle of nowhere.
Absolutely.
So being able to fly one in and have like a central stock of a few of them and a drone to deliver it there, that sounds like the right answer.
And, you know, like I mentioned, it's a student project. What I loved about this is that the German government has been getting involved to make sure the regulations on like par with what they need it to be. It's like everyone is involved to make sure that there is success in this realm. And they actually did a test flight on December 15th to show like how the drone works, how it would react in an emergency situation. So I love seeing that. But to me, what this means, it's like there's all these little projects coming around from all around the world about how drones are getting merged into the medical realm and how they're performing better. So I want to quickly give a shout out to those because I think this is the start of something much bigger than we realize right now. One of those being Zipline. So that's the company that Mauser's article mentioned. If you're not familiar, Zipline is a California-based catapult launching drone company. They load up these drones, launch them out at like, I think they reach 100 miles an hour within 0.5 seconds or something.
Goodness.
And then they fly to the over the destination that they need to, and they drop whatever payload they have with a parachute and then fly back to a landing zone. So you might be thinking, well, like, what are the places where this would get used? And it's mainly in Rwanda right now. Rwanda has a lot of remote villages, which, again, is not easy to access. They need access to, you know, blood deliveries has been the main thing, where it needs to be delivered in a timely fashion and it needs to be in an environment where it doesn't get spoiled. So out of Kigali, which, if I'm not mistaken, is the main hub in Rwanda, 75% of all blood deliveries is being done by Zipline, these drones.
Goodness. Wow.
Which is incredible. That's dude. Awesome. Imagine like a whole country is now like benefiting from this technology where they couldn't before. And then there's another initiative. This is in Uganda, and the Ugandan government is operating it, but Johnson & Johnson has been funding the project. It's for delivering HIV medicine. So again, HIV medicine, life-saving. You want to get it in on a time in a timely fashion.
Yeah.
But apparently there's like a lot of like sub-islands. I'm not great with geography, but apparently there's like a lot of sub-islands that make it really difficult to get there. And one of the people, one of the government officials in Uganda who does the transporting of the drugs, said that she almost drowned in her last delivery. So having a drone, which like makes their jobs much more seamless, has kind of started to revolutionize this whole process. And I think as time goes on, this is going to start becoming the norm. So the way that I've seen drones and drone deliveries be talked about most in the US has been with Amazon and getting your packages on time and whatever. But in the medical realm, it makes so much more sense. And I feel like I think early on, we talked about a university in the States. I think it was University of Maryland that did a heart delivery, like an organ delivery with a drone, because again, they could do it in a timely fashion as effective as possible. So I'm kind of going on a tangent, but drone deliveries for medical stuff, I think it's going to be this emerging field that's just going to grow exponentially in the next couple of years. And
me too. And I'm excited for that.
Me too, right? Dude.
We've got this technology. I don't, you know, need to see this applied to get my Amazon order to me in 30 minutes or less, or my DoorDash delivery, you know, from down the road to me in 30 minutes or less. But what I really would like to see is, you know, us using technology that's available to try and save lives, because where time is of the essence, it doesn't like just, we love to talk about first principles reasoning, zoom out, you know, get rid of all the dogma around the situation. Just say, why would you take a mode of travel on the ground that's convoluted, there's traffic, there's all these risks with driving high speed and maybe impacting another driver, or all these twists and turns, or maybe bad roads. Why would you take that suboptimal mode of transportation when we have technology available to fly through the sky, where flight paths are basically just a straight line? And they can fly faster, they can get things there better, and you can have really targeted drone drops, and you can reach remote areas. I mean, to me, again, I'm with you in terms of just using the technology we can to best save lives, to best impact people's lives. Drones and medical seem like a match made in heaven.
I couldn't agree with you more. That's really what I want to see. Like, if it means holding off on the Amazon stuff a little bit longer, totally okay with that. Invest it all into the medical realm. That's what I really want to see.
Yeah. Well, that's an awesome spot for us to wrap up the episode here. We're excited to be kicking it off in 2022. We're really excited about growing the podcast. One of the things I want to mention is Spotify just launched a platform on their mobile app where you can leave a review for us on a 1 to 5 star scale. So we've been asking so far, please, Apple Podcasts, if you listen there, leave us a review. We'd love if you listen on Spotify now on the mobile app to go ahead and leave us a review if you've enjoyed what you're listening to, if you're excited about the podcast growing. I still have to do it. For Bode, I think you still have to do it.
I do.
But let's get a bunch of people, let's rally around it. You guys, you Spotify listeners have been DMing us like, how can I help? And today,
it's your lucky
like,
day.
Until today, I've been saying like, hey, please share it with a friend. And that's helpful too. But today's your lucky day. If you listen on Spotify, we'd love if you just take a few seconds, leave us a review. It means the world to us, and it helps us grow and reach more people. And you can be a part of being why the podcast grows and helps more people access tech that they can understand.
Absolutely. And one more thing, we just started realizing that we can look at the different countries that we're trending in. So we're going to try to do shout outs every week. This week, it has been Ecuador and Albania. You guys are rocking. We see you. Thank you for your support. And
yeah,
that's awesome that we have supporters in Ecuador and Albania, dude. That's yeah, it still blows
it
my mind.
It brings a smile
every time.
To my face.
Absolutely. So thank you everyone for your support. And as always, we'll see you in the next episode.
Peace.
That's all for today. The Next Bite podcast is produced by WeVolver. And to learn more about the topics we discussed today, visit WeVolver.com. If you enjoy this episode, please review and subscribe via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or one of your favorite platforms. I'm Forbode.
And I'm Daniel.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.